This is lecture number 9 on Deuteronomy by Robert Bonoy of Biblical Theological Seminary. Lecture number 9. Referring to the outline, number 3 was absence of a historical prologue, and number 4 was absence of a basic stipulation. Remember, in the Hittite form, the basic stipulation is that fundamental obligation for loyalty of the vassal to the suzerain. It comes immediately after the prologue. The king says, "I've done this, and therefore you should work to serve me, the suzerain." Assyrian treaties don't have the basic stipulations, so that's a second structural difference between the Assyrian and the Hittite treaties. The declaration of allegiance to the head partner by the vassal follows closely the historical prologue in the Hittite treaties. Now, of course, you don't have a historical prologue in the Assyrian treaties, and so it follows that you don't have that basic stipulation. So instead of that, the Assyrian treaties have an oath of allegiance. But you notice that is quite a different context. Look what it's enclosed in. In the Assyrian treaties, that oath of allegiance follows curses, and then is followed by even more curses. So the oath is taken in the context of fear rather than one of trust and loyalty. In the Hittite treaties, you have the historical prologue followed by that basic stipulation, which is, as I've said, the suzerain says, "I've done this and that for you. Now on that basis of what I've done for you, serve me and be loyal to me." So again, it emphasizes the difference in the quality of the relationship between the two parties. All right, that's number 4, absence of a basic stipulation in the Assyrian treaties, contrasted to the Hittite treaties. Number 5 of the outline is absence of blessings. There's another structural difference in keeping with the harsh tone of the Assyrian treaties contrasted to the Hittite treaties. There are no blessings enumerated for keeping the treaty stipulations in the Assyrian treaties. The Hittite treaties have curses and blessings. The Assyrian treaties have only curses and no blessings. Blessing is one of the permanent fixtures in the Hittite treaties. So I think we could say that its absence, again, is an important difference when you compare the two groups of treaties, not only from the standpoint of structure, but also from the standpoint of the relationship that is being established between the two parties. As for curses and blessings, if you look at Exodus chapter 20, there is only a hint of blessing and cursing in the Decalogue, that is, the Ten Commandments. You get a hint of blessing in the commandment for honoring your parents. It says, "Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you." That would correspond to, if you do that, you will be blessed. And then you get a hint of a curse in, "You shall not take the Lord's name in vain. The Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." But the blessing and curse elements are not well worked out in the Decalogue. It's not with every one of the Ten Commandments that you see a blessing or a curse. But I think the element of cursing and blessing is there in the Ten Commandments, and it is certainly clearer in Deuteronomy as a whole. All right, that was number 5 of the outline. Number 6 is the stipulations of the Assyrian treaties are one-sided. The stipulations of the Assyrian treaties were aimed solely towards the minor partner, or vassal. In other words, the obligations of the minor partner are towards the great king. There is no hint of reciprocity of the great king's obligation to provide for and protect the vassal. Now that's something that's common in the Hittite treaties. In other words, in the Hittite treaties, not only is the great king saying, "Look, I want you to do this and that," he also obliges himself, as the suzerain, to do certain things on behalf of the vassal. So there is a reciprocal relationship there that's absent in the one-sided nature of Assyrian stipulations. We proceed. Number 7 of the outline is the Assyrian treaties are strictly succession treaties. The subject matter of the Assyrian treaties is quite different from that of the Hittite treaties. In the Assyrian treaties, the whole thing is directed to a particular issue, and that is the issue of succession. And that's the succession of King Ashurbanipal from King Esarhaddon. Ashurbanipal was the crown prince of Esarhaddon. So when you compare that with the Hittite treaties were not confined to merely one aspect of the relationship between the partners. The Hittite treaties cover a wide range of topics of importance on both sides of the agreement. And then we come finally to number 8 of the outline, and that is conclusion. It seems to me that we can say on the basis of these considerations that there are important differences between the treaties of Assyria and Esarhaddon and the Hittites. The structural pattern is different in the Assyrian treaties, and closely connected with that is a different spirit. So the relationship, instead of being one of mutual support, is one of harsh demand and threats by the Assyrian king that is placed on the vassal. Now, on the basis of those kinds of considerations, it seems to me that Meredith Klein does have a reasonable basis for saying that the Assyrian treaties are different from the earlier Hittite treaties. There is an evolution, or change, in the form of the treaties over that period of time. There's adequate reason for him to conclude that. Now, interestingly enough, Mendenhall, whom we've related before, who wrote that article in 1954 that called the attention to the treaty and covenant material, as well as William Foxville Albright and John Bright, among others, are in agreement with Klein on that issue. Mendenhall, in his original article, Law and Covenant, says the following: "This covenant type is even more important as a starting point of the study of Israelite traditions because of the fact that it cannot be proven to have survived the downfall of the great empires of the late 2nd millennium B.C. Notice the Assyrians are in the 1st millennium B.C. I continue with Mendenhall. "When empires rose again, notably Assyria, the structure of the covenant by which they bound their vassals is entirely different." And that was Mendenhall's statement. He said you can't prove that the original Hittite treaty survived into the next millennium in the period of the Assyrians. It was an entirely different structure to the treaties by the time the Assyrians came along. He says further, and I quote him here, "In all other materials, we have the historical prologue, and that's missing in the Assyrian treaties. And only the Assyrian deities are listed as witnesses. The entire pattern is also radically different. It is, of course, possible that the form survived elsewhere. But the writer has been able to find no evidence for this. We should also expect that even if it did survive, more or less, far-reaching changes in form would have taken place." End quote. Now, Albright, in his work, Stone Age to Christianity, agrees entirely with Mendenhall, and he says, quote, "The structure of half a dozen Assyrian treaties, which are found in Phoenician treaties that we know from the late 8th century B.C. and later, is quite different." And I end the quote here. This is similar to John Bright in his History of Israel, so I don't need to quote John Bright on this. So it puzzles me, given those considerations, why D.J. Weissman as well as McCarthy say that the form of the Assyrian treaty was essentially the same as the form of the Hittite treaty. But both Weissman, who published the Assyrian treaties, and McCarthy argue that the form is essentially the same. D.J. Weissman, in his publication of the treaties, in comments on it, says, and I quote him, "The form of the treaties was already standardized by the time of the Hittite Empire, and this text, that is the vassal treaty of Esarhaddon, shows that it remained basically unchanged through Neo-Assyrian times." End quote. He speaks to the standardized Hittite form, and he says that it's unchanged through the Assyrian time. Then McCarthy picks it up and supports Weissman, and he says, "It is said that the Assyrian and other treaties of the first millennium were comparatively different in structure from the Hittite form of the second millennium B.C. It seems to me that the analysis just completed fails to bear this out." End quote. And then we have the still more recent work of Moshe Weinfeld in his book Deuteronomy in the Deuteronomic School, in 1972, and he says, and I quote Weinfeld here, "There is no justification for regarding the formulation of the Hittite treaties as being unique. Nor is there any basis for Mendenhall's supposition that only Hittite treaties served as the model and archetype of the biblical covenant. End quote. Now, you can draw your own conclusions, but what you have is D.J. Weissman, McCarthy, and Weinfeld saying there's basically no difference between Assyrian and Hittite treaties. On the other hand, you have Klein, Albright, Bright, Mendenhall, and others saying there is a radical change between Hittite form and Assyrian form. Now, there are certain elements that are similar. You have stipulations, you have curses, you have witnesses. True, you have some similarities. But in the midst of similarities, my point is, and I think Mendenhall's point is, that there are some striking differences that are of enough significance that one cannot say that there have been no modifications of the form of the Hittite treaty by the time you get to the time of the Assyrians. In fact, the form that we have in the Assyrian treaties really fits in with what we know for Assyrian military techniques and strategies that we know were very violent and ruthless. They forced themselves on other people with terror, and the Assyrian treaty form really brings this out. But what Weinfeld does, and several others, including McCarthy, is argue that there is a treaty covenant form that is found in biblical materials, but it was taken from the Assyrians at a late date, around 600 or 700 BC, which gets around the historical implications of the Mosaic origin of Deuteronomy. We can't say that the Israelites got the treaty form from the Assyrians. It doesn't fit that form nearly as closely as the Hittite treaties. That's why this point is of such significance to Klein's argument. But I'll come back to that. Let's go on to capital D of the outline, and that is the Aramaic treaties from Sapphiri compared with the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon and with the Hittite suzerainty treaties. First, some introductory remarks. There were Aramaic treaties called the Sapphiri treaties. They date from the 8th century BC. They are a little bit earlier than the Assyrian treaties. Assyrian treaties were 672 BC. Sapphiri treaties were 8th century in the 700s BC. They're generally referred to as simply Sapphiri I, Sapphiri II, and Sapphiri III, as there are three treaty texts. Sapphiri Roman numeral I, Roman numeral II, and Roman numeral III, to be exact. And they were found in Sapphiri. It's a place in Syria. They were found about 60 years ago. But it wasn't until 1958 that they were published and have received some study. Two of them are in the Damascus, Syria Museum, and the other one is in a museum in Beirut, Lebanon. Well, let's go on to number two, a brief survey of the form of the Sapphiri treaties. And I have put an outline of the form there. Notice several parts to the treaty. Title, gods who were witnesses, curses with accompanying rites, sacred character of the treaty, stipulations, reminder for the future, blessings, and of course, curses. Now, that form with the parts that I just enumerated is taken from the first Sapphiri text, Roman numeral 1, which is a complete text. The others, Sapphiri 2 and 3, are quite fragmentary. But you have a title introducing the contracting parties. And it says, quote, the treaty of Virgaya in a certain place with Matiel, son of Upter Somas, the king of Pharphad, and so on. So you have the two partners of the treaty introduced. Now, is the treaty of Virgaya. That individual is not known apart from this reference to him. There's no other reference known. The land of which he was king is also not identified with certainty. The vassal Matiel is identified in another treaty of the Assyrians, the treaty of Ashur-Merari, the fifth ruler of Assyria. Matiel is a ruler in northern Syria between the Euphrates and the Mediterranean around the year 754 BC. Now, I'm not going to go down through all of these sections, but I think from the heading you can tell what type of material it is. But the curses with accompanying rites will have a section like this. And I'm quoting, just as this wax is burned by fire, so shall Arpad be burned in her daughter cities, end quote. So it sounds like they were burning wax, demonstrating the curse. The second Sefiri text, Sefiri Roman number 2, is very fragmentary. It was found in about a dozen pieces, and when the pieces were fitted together, you have portions of description that seem very similar to the structure of these texts. But it is not of great value for comparison to other treaties because of its fragmentary nature. The third document, Sefiri 3, is again fragmentary, but it has only stipulations. It's the only section left within the third document. That's section number 6 in the form of the treaty. But it has the most extensive collection of stipulations of any of these three texts. So you get an extensive understanding of stipulations. They concern things like the surrender of plotters, the surrender of fugitives, freedom of passage, crossing the borders, vengeance to be taken in case of assassination, reciprocal return of fugitives, and various things of that sort. The stipulations, as far as they are preserved, are one-sided, like the Assyrian ones. They regulate the conduct of the vassal. They're not of a reciprocal nature, with one exception, and that is the return of fugitives. So there is one exception, but generally the stipulations are one-sided. Well, let's go to number 3 of the outline, and let's talk about the similarities of these Sefiri treaties to the Assyrian treaties. If you look at the structure, you will find a similarity between the two in the absence of a historical prologue. Assyrian treaties, as we have mentioned before, have no historical prologue, and the Sefiri treaties have no historical prologue either. So in that sense, you can say that the Sefiri treaties are closer to the Assyrian treaties than they are to the Hittite treaties. They don't have a historical prologue, nor do they have the basic stipulation in there either. Remember, the basic stipulation gives the reason why the treaty has been inaugurated to begin with. Now on this, author Fitzmyer says, and I'm quoting here, "One element in particular is significantly absent, and that's the historical prologue. Whatever reason may be assigned for the omission of this element in the Aramaic treaties, the absence of it constitutes a major difference between the Aramaic and the Hittite treaties. This element is basic to the Hittite concept of the covenant. It constitutes a legal framework of the Hittite suzerainty treaties. Hittite suzerains recalled favors towards their vassals as well as those of their predecessors in order to establish the obligations for the vassals' service. Indeed, it is precisely this element that is absent from the covenants of the first millennium BC, whether they be Aramaic or Assyrian." End quote. This qualification seems to be necessary in light of the comments made by Weissman that the covenant form remained basically unchanged through Neo-Assyrian times. You see, we are back to that point of dispute. Fitzmyer publishes the Aramaic inscriptions of Sefiri. That's this volume. We can read the text and its comments on it. Second, not only is a historical prologue and that basic stipulation missing, but also the stipulations are one-sided. I already mentioned that, with the exception of the return of fugitives, these stipulations are one-sided. That again contrasts with the Hittite treaties. I mentioned that before in connection with the Assyrian treaties, which are also one-sided. You see, in the Hittite treaties, you often have what are called, quote, protection clauses, end quote, where the great king commits himself to protecting the vassal. Another author, F.C. Fenchum, says the following: "One of the most humane stipulations in the Hittite treaty is the promise of protection of the vassal against enemies. This protection might have been promised to safeguard the head partner's kingdom, but was still a most encouraging experience for the vassal. There was no enemy to fear. Under such conditions, small kingdoms could prosper at times of peaceful coexistence. There was no protection clause in the Assyrian treaties or in the Sefiri treaties." End quote. Another difference is the placement of the witness section. In the Sefiri treaties, the gods are called upon as witnesses right after the introductory paragraph, title, or preamble. Notice where the witnesses are in the Hittite treaty. It's after the stipulations rather than before. So in this Sephire follows more closely the Assyrian form than it does the Hittite form. The Assyrian form has gods as witnesses right after the preamble or title. There are certain similarities, even though there are those differences we just looked at. There are certain things where the Sephire treaties are closer to the Hittite treaties than they are for the Assyrian treaties, and you see that, first of all, in that gods of both partners are listed as witnesses in Sephire, but only gods of the Assyrians in the Assyrian treaties. The gods of both the great king and vassal are cited in the Aramaic treaties. Similarly, in the Hittite treaties, the gods of both partners are witnesses, the gods of the great king as well as those of the vassal. But the Assyrian treaties, as I mentioned, name only Assyrian deities. They don't name the deities of the minor partner. So at point, the Sephire treaties are closer to the Hittite treaties than to the Assyrian treaties when it comes to the naming of the gods. Third, the subject matter of the stipulations is broader than the Assyrian treaties. Assyrian treaties are concerned only with succession. The Sephire treaties are much broader in scope, and in that sense, they are a lot closer to the Hittite treaties. And then fourth, Fitzmyer, whom I mentioned before in his discussion of the Sephire treaties, points out that the style of formulation of some of the stipulations is very close to the stipulations of the Hittite treaty formulation. There is a very close correspondence, so you can point that out too for similarities between Sephire and the Hittites. And that brings me to number five, the conclusion. I think we can conclude that the treaties of Sephire exhibit some affinities with the earlier Hittite treaties, but at the same time, there are very important differences, and in particular, the absence of a historical prologue, back to that again, and the basic stipulations, back to that too again, and the one-sided nature of the basic stipulations that we have. So it seems like you have a progression in the treaty form. You have the classic Hittite form, then you get the Sephire treaties, and then you're down to the Esarhaddon Assyrian treaties. Sephire has more relation to the Hittite form than the Assyrian does, but the Sephire treaties are somewhere halfway in between, you could say, in terms of structure and content, halfway in between the Hittite and the Assyrian. There are some likenesses to the Assyrian treaties and some to the Hittite treaties, but it does seem like what Klein says about an evolution in the development of the form of the treaty is indeed correct. The Sephire and the Assyrian treaties seem to be more based on fear, whereas the Hittite treaties are based more on trust and loyalty. The vassal had reason to respond with loyalty to the Hittite great king because of all good things that the Hittite great king had done for the vassal. Now, a lot of people are trying to get around the force of Klein's model by saying that there's really not very much difference between the two types of treaties, that is, between the Hittites and Sephire and the Hittites and the Assyrians. But if you look at them and you look at that structure, Klein is absolutely justified in concluding that there is a real difference between the classic Hittite form and the later Assyrian or Aramaic Sephire form. We do have a parity treaty between Ramses II and the Hittite ruler, and we do have a copy of that. Since Egypt and the Hittites had relations, Moses may very well have had knowledge of these types of documents since they were written in the time of his existence. And this brings me to capital C, the implications of the treaty covenant analogy for the date of Deuteronomy. It seems to me that the evidence justifies the conclusion that the Hittite treaties can be said to represent a unique early form of the treaty that is not duplicated in later treaties, either those of Esarhaddon or those of Sephire. Now, closely connected with that is the different spirit reflected in the Hittite treaties. They are rooted in the gratitude and respect of the vassal for the suzerain, or the great king. The Assyrian treaties, on the other hand, are of a different structure, and they have an entirely different spirit. The Sephire treaties have some similarities to the Hittite treaties, more so to the Assyrians, however, but they also lack an important historical prologue and basic stipulation. So then I think that Klein speaks with good reason of the evolution of the documentary form of suzerainty treaties. He admits that the differences should not be exaggerated, that it is indeed one species that you meet through Old Testament times, but he does find a discernible evolution in the form. Then he says, and I'm quoting Klein here, Deuteronomy corresponds more closely in structure and spirit to the earlier Hittite treaties than to either the Sapphiri treaties or the Assyrian treaties in the 8th and 7th centuries. End quote. And I think that Klein's conclusion has a great deal of merit and deserves attention more so than has been received, particularly by some of the critical scholars. Klein concludes on page 43 of his work, Treaty of the Great King, and I quote him again, "While it is necessary to recognize the substantial continuity in matter between the earlier and later treaties, it is proper to distinguish the Hittite treaties of the second millennium B.C. as the classic form. Without any doubt, the Book of Deuteronomy belongs to the classic age of this documentary evolution. Here, then, is confirmation of the prima facie Mosaic origin of Deuteronomy as a treaty of the great king." End quote. Well, that's the essence of his thesis, and I think he is absolutely warranted in his conclusion. Now, to go a bit beyond that, you're reading J. Thompson in his Tyndale commentary, and he says in the commentary on pages 51 and 52 that he has reservations about the strength of Klein's argument. As you read Thompson, you'll find he argues for a date of Deuteronomy in the 11th and 10th centuries B.C., roughly in the time of the United Monarchy during the reigns of David and Solomon. So he finds it post-Mosaic, but early in terms of the kingdom. He sees Moses behind the heart of the book, but he thinks editorial processes have brought it to the present form, and that is subsequent to the time of Moses. In other words, he doesn't accept Klein's thesis that this form supports a Mosaic date for the origin of Deuteronomy. Now, Thompson suggests this with respect to Klein's thesis, and I quote him, "Deuteronomy was put in the shape of a treaty form by someone writing long after Moses' day." End quote. In other words, he doesn't deny the treaty covenant analogy, but he says the form could have been adopted later on. His view there is very similar to the view of R. Frankena. In Frankena's work, The Vassal Treaties of Esarhaddon and the Dating of Deuteronomy, Frankena looks at the Assyrian treaties and argues for Hebrew dependence on the Assyrian treaties, in particular the curse formulations in relationship to the Deuteronomy curse formulations. He says, and I quote Frankena here, "They are closely related to the form of the Assyrian treaties," end quote. So he is relating them now to this time. As I mentioned already, Weinfield speaks of court scribes in the time of Hezekiah and Joshua being familiar with the Assyrian treaty form and bringing it into Israel. So from that mechanism, it was used in Deuteronomy. So on that, Thompson's comment is, quote, "The possibility must be allowed that Deuteronomy was cast in the shape of an ancient treaty by someone who wrote long after Moses' day," end quote. And that's one thing he says. Another thing he is saying is the following, and I quote him here, "The historical prologue argument is not sound because the Assyrian or Aramaic treaties may have either assumed a prologue or it may have been stated orally," end quote. So he doesn't deny that it's absent, but he just says they may have assumed the historical prologue or stated it orally rather than writing it down on the text, and that's why it's not in the text. Therefore, he says, you cannot make much of its not having a historical prologue. In addition, he claims evidence of a 7th century treaty text with a historical prologue. The problem is that it is a disputed text that he brings up. It is very fragmented and broken, and we've looked at people who have disputed whether there's a historical prologue there or not. But in any case, Thompson attempts to weaken the case for the evolution of the treaty form by suggesting that the historical prologue is not a unique feature of the early Hittite treaties. So he concludes, and I quote him here, "Hence the fact that Deuteronomy has a historical introduction is not necessarily an argument for the date in the second millennium B.C., although it may be, and so, you see, he even hedges his bet here." Well, I guess my time is up. I can't go much longer, but I want to interact with Thompson not only on those two arguments, that is, the historical prologue argument and the idea that it was put in the treaty form by someone later than Moses. I'll comment on that and then a couple other arguments, but we'll have to do that at the beginning of the next week before we discuss the centralization of worship issue. I think it is important to interact with Thompson because Thompson's commentary is in the InterVarsity Tyndale series, which is an evangelical series. We might expect that Thompson would support a Mosaic date and would buy into Klein's argument, but alas, he does not. That is the end of lecture number 9 on Deuteronomy by Robert Vinoy of Biblical Theological Seminary.